Readers Entertainment Radio, where variety is the spice of life.
Well, hello and welcome to Readers Entertainment Radio. I'm your host, Sheila English, and tonight we have an exciting and intriguing show with a guest that knows a lot of the behind the scenes of IBM's Watson. I have to say I've been looking forward to doing this show all week. I give a shout out to my dad because I know he's listening. We've been talking about this show all week, and so I have a lot of my friends that I know are listening in. Now, in case you didn't see the momentous Jeopardy show, Watson played some of the top contestants to ever play on the popular show, and Watson won. So, but of course, not without some funny moments, which we'll be able to talk about. Our guest tonight is the author of Final Jeopardy, Man vs. Machine, and the Quest to Know Everything. Welcome to Stephen Baker.
Hi. Hi, Sheila.
Great to have you on the show. Of course, we've talked several times, and it's every time I get a chance to talk to you, I'm always wondering how you felt about the way that the game went and stuff like that. You just have so much knowledge about the ins and outs of the happenings with Watson. So I'm so thrilled that you found time to spend with us. Now, for our listeners. We have a live chat session going up, so you can click on the chat session and send us some questions or talk amongst yourselves. I did put a link up there if you want to go over and look at the website. The website's very intriguing. As a matter of fact, I was just there a moment ago, and it says, What Charlie Chan Could Teach Watson. I thought, okay, I've got to read that. So definitely for our listeners, go check that out. You can also call into the show at 646-200-4071. About an hour after the show, you can download the podcast. If you want to listen to that on your iPod or you want to put that on your website, you can do that as well. We will also put it up on readersentertainment.com. So if you have questions later, if you're just downloading the podcast, you didn't make the live show but have questions, make sure you go on over there and you can post some questions. We'll make sure that Stephen gets those. Stephen, this has been an exciting story from start to finish. Tell us how you got involved in this.
Well, I had been at Business Week, and I was covering IBM, and my time at Business Week was running out. I was going to leave the magazine, but I really wanted a book project. And so a couple weeks before I left Business Week, I had lunch with the IBM people, and they told me about this machine they were building that was going to play Jeopardy. And I'd written a previous book called The Numerati, and so I really wanted to write another book, but the kind of book I wanted to write ideally would have a story. It would have a beginning and it would have an end, and it would tell the story of some sort of effort, people building something, because I wanted to have a narrative. And there was no better narrative that I could ever dream of than one where people are actually building a machine to take on human champions in Jeopardy, and at the end you actually have a championship match. It was a dream come true for me.
Now, what was it like? You actually got to go to the IBM office, right?
Oh, I was in the labs there, yeah, in Yorktown, New York, and in Hawthorne, New York, yeah.
So what kind of things did you get to see or do or watch?
Well, I spent a lot of time with the researchers, and what's interesting is that when you think of computer researchers, you think of people doing math and science, which these people do, but because of the challenge, because they had to build a machine that had to deal with language and general human knowledge, these people spent an awful lot of time trying to work out language. And teaching Watson English was really the most fascinating job, because you think this machine is severely handicapped in language. It doesn't have a clue. And so everything that they teach it has to be meticulously designed so that the machine can make sense of English and not make an utter fool of itself. So I really enjoyed, as sort of a word person, watching these scientists wrestle with language. And they understood, and they deal with language in so much more detail than I as a writer ever had to.
So, and just for our listeners, just to kind of talk, I wanted to talk a little bit about the challenges of language for Watson. The fact that you know, we kind of turn regular everyday language into almost like a slang. You know, people come over and say, "What's up?" You know, and we're not really wondering what is up in the sky, or, you know, it's like, you know, what are you doing? And those kinds of challenges. Now, how did they deal with things like that?
Well, one of the things that Watson has and benefits from that other previous computers didn't have is that Watson, because it is developed in this decade, has access to trillions of words. And words in blog posts and in newspaper articles and all of these words that are on the networks. And so it's an enormous set of data that Watson can begin to study and look at the statistics of how certain words are used and what they mean when they're near other words. You know, spot means something when it's in a sentence with a dog, and it means something else when it's in a sentence with the sun.
Right.
and so the computer can start to draw those correlations, and doing that can start to make sense of language.
Now, was there a particular moment when you were at IBM watching all the behind the scenes drama that you thought, this is so amazing? Did you have like some amazing moments or some epiphanies as this was going on?
Well, I had this idea. You know, the first time I saw Watson in action, it was it blew my mind that this machine was all by itself understanding. I shouldn't use the word when I use the word understanding with this machine, I have to put up the quote signs with my fingers, but making sense of really difficult questions and fishing up the answers in 2 or 3 seconds. And I thought, it made me think about the human brain, because we have so many of us are paid to look up things and come up with answers. And if machines can do this kind of work and can do it for us, what should we keep in our own heads? And so my epiphany was really about the human brain and how what we're going to do if machines start behaving like Watson, which they are no doubt going to do very quickly.
And, you know, reading the book, I know you talk about that as well. And what I really loved about the book is that everything that I just felt like naturally most people would be interested in knowing about Watson and about all those things, those were all addressed there. But you actually had a lot of things I didn't even think about. And that was one of those things. You know, it's like, well, if you have this, this computer that can store all this information for you, that can actually, you know, answer natural questions and give you a correct answer, then, you know, will you bother to remember those things? How is that going to affect school? And, you know, and at first when you think about that, it's like, oh, you know, I don't see that happening or whatever. But then I put it in context. I was talking to my husband. It's like, you know what, my spelling and my handwriting have suffered because of technology.
Right.
I actually have to really stop and think about if I'm writing something out in cursive, there are certain letters like, oh, I don't know if I remember how to make that letter, which is just terrible because I hardly ever handwrite anything anymore. And then, you know, as far as spelling, I am so dependent upon spell check that I really, if I'm handwriting something out, I have to stop and go and look it up because I'm not remembering it, because I allow a computer to store that information for me, and so I don't do it anymore.
Right. Well, think about, I mean, you know, we used to have all these skills, like, you know, people used to know how to whittle. You take a piece of wood and you whittle on it, right?
Right.
And that was a useful thing to do because you'd fix the leg of a chair, you'd, you know, do handy work around the house with being able to whittle. And since plastics have come in, nobody bothers to whittle anymore except for to kill time. And there are all these different advances of technology that have changed what we have, the skills that we have to learn. But think about this, Sheila. If Watson were given the SAT test, how would it do? The college examination test. And if a machine could do well in the SAT test, are we teaching our kids the right things? Because they're going to be competing with these machines for jobs.
Well, you know what? That's a really excellent point. You know, and it kind of makes you wonder, will our children's children be taking different kinds of classes in the future because the things they're learning now are going to be taken care of by computers like Watson? So what is it that we as people can do that the computers can't do, which has always been a challenge since the first computer came out?
Well, I'll tell you one thing we can do that they can't do is have a conversation like the kind you and I are having right now.
Right.
And so those sorts of social skills are things that people remain supreme at. I mean, people are, and I go into this in the book because I talk about, going to these various laboratories of artificial intelligence, and some of the people are, kind of down on Watson because it is really, in essence, despite its brilliance in this one domain, not a highly intelligent machine. It can't come up with ideas, it can't come up with theories, it can't carry on a conversation. All it can do is what it's trained to do, which is answer questions. And so if you look at Watson's limitations, then you get sort of a roadmap for where people can continue to thrive. And there are plenty of areas, but we have to watch out for those areas where we're going to get smushed by machines like Watson.
I think that is such an excellent point, because one thing is, the whole idea of customer service and social skills has been, it's been really evolving because people are now even becoming social online. I mean, you almost have a different set of etiquette when you're online as to when you're personal, one-on-one. But you're right, that the whole social skill thing, that's going to be a real challenge because, people who are online all the time, and I'm one of those people, you really have to fine-tune your social skills when, like next week I'm going out to a convention, I'm going to have to actually be face-to-face with those people. So it's almost like online computers, that whole online, landscape is actually dampening my social skills as well. But from what you're saying, I'm thinking, I need to really concentrate on those skills because that's something I can give that the computer cannot give. That's going to be a really important skill later on.
You have the ability to read other people, and the computer cannot do that. And so if you're working in customer service or sales or any area like that, and you can look at how that person's fidgeting or how that person's face brightens up when you mention one thing and turns confused when you say something else, then you as a person have it all over the computer, which can do nothing but provide answers.
Exactly. And we have Bob Gollinger, who's in the chat room. Hi, Bob. And his comment was, the social skill thing is already in jeopardy. And what I'm getting from you, Stephen, is that people need to really think about those things that are humanistic that we bring to the table that can't easily be replaced. So I think Bob's right. The social skill thing, a lot of people are losing their social skills, but they really need to start looking at the future and becoming better with their social skills. And I think customer service is another area where I don't think it's going to be hard to replace people in jobs
like
that.
Well, the thing is this, though. If you have a bunch of people in a call center whose job is to respond to phone calls and then find answers and then respond to the people, perhaps two people using a machine will be able to combine their social skills with the answers from the machine and displace a number of people. And that's going to be a real challenge for our society.
Yeah, that's a good point. It does make you wonder what kinds of jobs are going to be, what people are going to be clamoring for, to be, right now it's a doctor and a lawyer, and I know that, with Watson there's going to be a lot of things that Watson can do with, like, in the medical field and stuff like that. So, the jobs of the future, I'm just wondering what are those going to be for people?
Well, we should make it clear to people so that they know that we know that Watson is highly fallible. Right. I mean,
right.
Watson lacks common sense, has, some kind of simulation of common sense programmed into it. But Watson can make the most ludicrous mistakes And so before people think that you and I are saying that Watson's going to become the next doctor, I think we should make
right.
it clear that Watson is going to be, or machines like Watson are going to be tools that that doctors use to comb through data and come up with suggestions. But it's going to be up to the humans to vet these suggestions and pick out the ones that make sense.
Right, right. Well, it's like when a doctor interprets, you know, like your lab tests. You know, there could be a lot of different answers, but he has to put together, he has to look at you. He touches you. He interacts with you and puts together every resource that's available to him to come up with the answer. So it's not just something that, you know, he relies on one resource. So, but yeah, absolutely not saying Watson's we do not have Dr. Watson yet. So we're okay.
As a matter of fact, the IBM people, before a program that I did, they explicitly told me, our lawyers have told us to avoid using the term Dr. Watson.
Oh, that's funny.
Because they don't even want to get into that mess where people have these, well, not only the expectations, but more the fears that doctors are going to be replaced by machines.
Now, I think that's really interesting. Now it's not just medical field, though. Like I was thinking, you know, lawyers could use this, attorneys. You program in all these, you know, from all over the United States, all these different cases and results, and, you know, to be able to put all that information into a single place and then, you know, ask a Watson-esque kind of machine, you know, okay, this is the situation, you know, in this case, you know, what's available for me if I want to do this about this case and have that, you know, have that come up. So there's lots
right.
of other practical things that we can do with Watson, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, this type of machine would really help in answering questions about law is a little bit difficult. I mean, there's possibilities in law, but law has a lot of interpretation to it. But there are other areas where things are really in black and white, like government bureaucracies. Which forms do you need for various, you know, tax forms and small
right.
business and this and that, where you wait on the phone for 20 minutes to get somebody to answer that question, and a machine could do it pretty quickly without running it through a huge menu. I was in the IRS today, and I went through like 16 menu items, you know.
Right. Well, you know, and that kind of begs the question a little bit of, you know, how is Watson different from Google? Why can't I just Google something?
The difference between Watson and Google is that Google basically uses your brain a lot to do its job. It says to you, please make it really simple for me and give me maybe three words that'll zero me in on exactly what you might be looking for. So please use your brain to help focus me as clearly as possible. And then it says, you know, I'm going to take you to web pages, and then I'm going to leave it to your magnificent mind to find what you're looking for, because I don't really know. All I know is you're looking for these three words. And so it's up to you, once you get to that web page, to find the answer. Watson has to make sense of a really complex English question. And then it has to go on a hunt, look at millions of documents, and not only find the document that might have the answer, but actually formulate the answer and develop enough confidence in it that it can decide to bet on it. And so it's a much more complex process. And you might think, oh, so Watson's going to be the next search. But that isn't going to happen anytime soon, because Watson probably consumes a billion times more computing resources per question than Google. So it doesn't make sense economically.
Now, let me ask you, when you started working on the book, Final
mm-hmm.
Jeopardy, did you already have an idea of the outline for the book, or did your experiences when you were there kind of dictate the flow of the book?
Well, I would say both. I mean, I had the idea that I wanted to write the book like a sports season. I was thinking of, you know, Friday Night Lights, or
uh-huh.
there was a really good book I read about a season with Bobby Knight and the Indiana basketball team. And I thought, that is, you know, you start with these people and it's a klutzy team and they don't know what they're doing, and you get to know the different people and they're working towards a common goal, and it culminates with a championship. So that was the narration I had. And I also knew that I had to get away from IBM, because people get a little stir crazy if the whole book's about, you know, just doesn't leave these laboratories. So I had to get out and talk to other people in the industry about artificial intelligence and where Watson fit into it and why some people don't think Watson's such hot stuff. And because it couldn't read like an IBM, you know, it had to be a bit skeptical about some of these things to be believable and to be interesting and to be true.
Well, I'll tell you, the book is, I really love the book, and it caused a lot of conversation. I mean, just within my own friends and family, you know, we start talking about some of the issues that you bring up in the book, those things, like I said, you know, it's like, oh, I didn't even think about that. And then you think about it, and it's like, well, you know, how is that going to affect jobs? How is that going to, you know, what really does, this was the big conversation that we had, was, you know, well, what does constitute artificial intelligence? If this isn't it, how close are we? What are those final steps that's going to give us that? So the book really is it causes conversation. It was never like a manual type book. It really flowed. You know, it's like, oh, I was really excited to read the book and then have those conversations.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. The question you raised that came out of the book, you know, what is artificial intelligence? That's really a big one. And see, I don't think, for my purposes, it doesn't matter that much, because I think I think the IBM team is pragmatic, and I kind of feel pragmatic too, which is you build machines that can do things, and these machines are tools, and they are really smart in one area and not nearly as smart as us in most of the rest,
right.
And that's okay. And if you try to build a machine that is as smart as a human in every area, well, you're not going to get there in our lifetime. And
yeah.
So, you know, I'm not expecting one. I'm just you know, amazed by machines like Watson and where machines like this can go in 10 years, but it's not going to be carrying on a conversation like the kind you and I are having right now.
Now, Watson truly is amazing and just is doing a lot of amazing things, but there were a lot of funny moments behind the scenes. I know you talk about that a little bit in the book too. Tell us some funny things that happened as Watson was getting ready to was preparing for Final Jeopardy.
Well, I tell you, you know, Watson, first of all, there was this one day when Watson was doing a practice round, and they had the New York Times guy there. He was doing a magazine article for it, and Watson was acting like a total dope. And David Ferrucci, who's the chief scientist, was beside himself. He was wondering if half the system was down, was not, you know, Watson was semi-crashed. He was going nuts. And Watson, during this time, was making absolutely ludicrous bets. At one point, it was behind by thousands of dollars, and it landed on a daily double. This was its big chance to catch up, and it bet $5. And Ferrucci was almost going to tear his hair out. And he was screaming at the members of the team and telling them that he wanted to back up all their data and get it to their colleagues right away, that they had to work. This is like, it was, you would have thought it was a medical emergency, what was going on with Watson. And then Watson began mispronouncing certain words. It began adding D's to words that ended in N and answering questions like Pakistan. And every time the judge, who was a real stickler, would dock Watson and not give it credit for getting the question right. And so this added to Ferrucci's anxiety. And in the middle of this, of course, in the middle of all this drama, was this machine that really didn't care at all what people thought. And it was cool as a cucumber, even as it crashed.
Now, you know, you were talking about betting. I wanted to talk a little bit about the 3 days of Final Jeopardy. I know you watched it. You know, I my husband and I were glued to it. The betting thing was still kind of funny. He was making
the betting
some funny
thing.
Bets.
Well, I mean, I think Watson, you know, they trained Watson to go through literally millions of simulated games so it could actually figure out the optimized bet for every single situation that it faced. And the machines just, you know, just run entirely by statistics. And so it actually can calculate at every juncture of the game what its chances are of winning. And so, you know, maybe the betting seemed weird, but I thought the betting in the final game was pretty much on target. It, you know, it made some stupid mistakes. It in one question about U.S. cities, it answered Toronto, which didn't make it look too smart. And so there was that. But, no, I thought the betting was kind of pretty smart. For example, at the end of the first game, which ended on Tuesday, and where Watson screwed up in the final Jeopardy with that Toronto answer, it sort of knew, as again I put it in quotes, enough not to put itself at risk with a big bet in final Jeopardy. A lot of people would have said, you know, I'm far ahead. If I just bet a lot, I can literally bury my opponents.
Right.
Watson has an understanding that it doesn't do as well in Final Jeopardy as in other clues. And so it's less likely to bet a lot, to risk a lot in Final Jeopardy, because it knows it makes it vulnerable. And so even though it screwed up on that clue, it bet less than $1,000, which was brilliant, because it left it with a huge advantage for the second game.
Now, we've got about 4 minutes left, but I've got to ask you, What was it like for you after all the things that you had worked on? You'd been to IBM, you talked to all these other people. What was it like for you to watch Final Jeopardy those 3 days?
Well, the thing is, Sheila, I'd watched it a month before. See, I had watched it in January when it was being taped.
Uh-huh.
And then so for me, it was, well, I was full of anxiety because I knew I suspected my book would sell a lot better if it was about a winner than a loser. So I was cheering enthusiastically for the computer. But then after that, this is in mid-January, I came back and I had to write the final chapter the following weekend. And that was interesting because I got to talk to Ken and Brad, and I got to talk to Alex Trebek, who was very upset about the way things had worked out and didn't think it was quite fair that Watson had an advantage on the buzzer, and that he had some other complaints about it that I talk about in the book. And then I wrote it really quickly, and then we had to get that into the book so that the book could be out with the final chapter the day after the matches were shown on TV.
Right. You know, you were talking a little bit about, you know, Watson did make the Toronto mistake. I felt that his making an error, and the fact that some of his bets were kind of odd numbers and people mm-hmm. would laugh, I actually felt that endeared him to people. I think we wanted him to not just be a robot, that we wanted to feel some kind of connection to him, because, you know, it is a very popular show, Jeopardy, very popular show. But I felt that. It's like, okay, he made this big mistake, and you heard, you know, people like, oh, no. But I really felt like it was like, if that had been a person who was doing so well, and of course Watson did so well, and then made this big mistake, that would have been the same exact reaction. They reacted just like it was a person. It's like, oh, no, I can't believe they made that mistake. So it was...
Put a lot of work into, I mean, there's a whole chapter in the book about the branding of Watson and how to make it seem like it's not threatening, and what voice and what avatar to pick from it, and how to deal with people's fears about smart computers. And so that was a big deal. The fact that you felt that way means that IBM did its job well, because they were worried that people would resent Watson. And, you know, and some people do. And some people attribute all of its success to speed on the buzzer. You think, well, you can have speed on the buzzer, but you have to have the right answer. You're going to lose. You know, wrong answers on fast buzzer is a ticket to disaster.
Right. Well, now we're down to our last minute. Tell us what's next for you.
Well, I don't know, Sheila. I'm waiting for my next big project. I haven't got a book contract right now, and I'm kind of nosing around for one. I assume it'll have something to do with technology, and I'm sure I'm going to do another book, but I haven't figured out exactly which one to do. So if people have ideas, they can come to my website. It's finaljeopardy.net, and I encourage them to come there. And if they have ideas about books that I should do, please, you know, let me know. I'm open to ideas.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And I want to thank our listeners for joining us here at Readers Entertainment Radio. This show will be downloadable within the hour if you want to download it. And or you can go to readersentertainment.com/radio. We'll make sure that we have all of the appropriate websites, URLs, or will all be up there. And again, thank you so much. I'm your host, Sheila English, and happy reading, everybody.
This show brought to you by Circle of Seven Productions, www.cosproductions.com. Please be sure to subscribe, and welcome to our circle.